Hello, I'm Joe Glenton, and this is Series 3 of the Warrior Nation podcast, where we'll be unpacking the complex relationship between war and memory, covering statues, PTSD, and everything in between. Today, I'm joined by academic Jerry Lemke, Professor of Sociology at the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts, a Vietnam veteran and author of the book PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America.
Okay, then if you're ready, Jerry, we'll go into the first question. So I've obviously I'm a veteran as well, and I've noticed since for about the last 15 years since the war on terror started, a number of the narratives around the war on terror have been coloured, I suppose, by this different kinds of stab in the back theory. I suppose the big one in this country is that it generally seems to originate from generals, is that these kind of effete liberal politicians betrayed us. We didn't have enough equipment. We pulled out of Afghanistan too fast and so on. But the fact that these theories exist, stab in the back theories, the Dolstoss exists, has become very, very apparent to me. And I know you've written on these a lot in the context of Vietnam. Could you just unpack what we mean when we say the stab in the back theory in this context, what we mean by the Dolstoss?
Well, it's really a betrayal narrative for a lost war that preserves notions of national and racial superiority. In other words, it allows the people to say we weren't defeated by them, an undereducated, undeveloped nation of racial and ethnic others. We lost the war because we were betrayed by elements within our own population. That is to say, we were stabbed in the back. We were beaten from those behind us. And the real danger in that, as I see it, is that that also keeps alive the idea that we could have won that war if those on the home front would have stayed loyal to the cause, if they would have stayed committed to the people who were sent to fight the war. And so the military establishment, and as we call it here in the States, the military-industrial complex, then is able to recycle that idea that we can go off to war in a place like Vietnam. And certainly that came into play with the case of Afghanistan. There was, certainly in our press, the notion that Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires was repeated. So the American people were not oblivious to that. But this idea that, by golly, if we just stand behind the troops this time, we won't end up in that graveyard. We will be able to persevere. We will be the exception to the historical rule, and we will be able to triumph. And so off we went.
There's a particularly memorable, there's lots of memorable passages in your books, but one that really stuck out to me was a discussion about historical examples of this, because this isn't new. The stab in the back theory being developed by a defeated army is not at all new, is it? I know in, you talk about examples, you go back into antiquity and you talk about Odysseus and his return home and the figure of his wife as a potential betrayer. You talk about the Confederates and the origins of the Ku Klux Klan. You talk about the French in Algeria and Indochina and how stabbing the back theories developed about that kind of weak, decadent society that didn't support the wars. Could you just expand on that a little bit, just so our listeners can understand?
Well, you've already covered a lot of ground there in formulating the question. It does go back a long way. For us here in the States, I suppose a kind of bedrock of that is the Civil War and feelings in the Southern Confederacy that was defeated, that there were disloyal elements within the South who betrayed the cause. And a lot of those elements were white. And after the Civil War, then, organizations like the Ku Klux Klan that are best remembered even in this country as remembered correctly for their racist acts, the acts of vengeance that they took out against freed slaves, Black Americans. But it's oftentimes forgotten that those organizations like the Klan also went after whites who were thought to have not been totally on board with the Southern cause. That then, of course, perpetuated and still kind of runs deeply through political culture, political ideology in the South today. But undoubtedly, for me anyway, the most strong expression of this stab in the back theory came out of Germany after World War I, the Dolchstoss legend, that it was Jews who did not support the German military. It was communists and other leftists who did not support it. It was pacifists who did not support it. And a story circulated after the war that when German soldiers came home, then they were treated badly by the people who had opposed the war. That is, the opponents of the war took out their frustrations about the war on those who had been sent to fight the war. So stories circulated, and they were written in diaries. They were written in memoirs by German soldiers that when they came home, they had insignia ripped off their uniforms. They were spat on. Oftentimes, the spitters were women. And they were generally kind of socially marginalized by the German population when they came home. And that then is what some historians say also then fed the revanchist elements within German culture that said that not only then do we have to avenge the bad treatment that our soldiers got by going after these Jews, going after these communists, going after the pacifist movement, but we have to rearm and we have to show the world that a united Germany can enter war again. And this time come out triumphant, and we can win. So that strain of historical research then attributes the Dolchstoss legend as a causative factor, anyway, in the lead up to the Nazi movement. And we can come back to that, by the way, if you wish, but certainly led up to the scapegoating of Jews, the anti-communist movement in Germany, and packaged together, then that becomes part of what leads Germany back into war.
You mentioned it there, and I think I mentioned it in the question, but there are some, when we talk about the enemy within, this kind of created enemy, there are often distinct features, and that the figure of the enemy is often either a woman, particularly in the case of Vietnam, the image of a woman spitting on a veteran, or is at least kind of feminized. Is sometimes a hippie in the Vietnam case. And you talk brilliantly about the connection between the spitting, the idea of fluids, and the way it's somehow an expression of women's wickedness. Could you just unpack that for me? Because I found it absolutely fascinating how you talked about the image of the inside, the traitor from inside, which is conjured in these mythologies.
Sure. Part of the betrayal narrative, an important part of the betrayal narrative, runs that it's the weakness in the culture. It's the weakness in German culture. It was weakness in the American culture that is maybe a constant presence in our culture. But during the war in Vietnam, that weakness kind of bubbled to the surface, became more prevalent, became more expressed, culturally expressed in the country during the war. And there's a fear that weakness resides within all of us, within men and within women. And that if it's not restrained, if it's not suppressed, then it weakens the society as a whole. So there was a feeling, and this is maybe slightly tangential to the question, but it's important. There was a feeling that America in its post-World War II years had become soft. We had lost our manlike will to war. And there is a term that's used quite commonly now in the literature, that it was momism that had weakened America, that the urbanization of American culture had moved boys and young men further away from their fathers and more under the care of their mothers. And so we had become weak. And so when we lost the war in Vietnam, some people who subscribe to this weakness theory or this strain of thinking said that, well, these boys who we sent off to fight in Vietnam were really not up to the task. They were not the men of the greatest generation who had won the war in World War II. So Vietnam veterans came home. Indeed, and this is historically documented, Vietnam veterans were in good part rejected by those older generation of veterans. Now, all of this gets genderized. The theory is that men project their own weakness outwardly. We project it onto the sexual other, women. It's not really a weakness indigenous to ourselves that we have to fear. It's an externality. It's a weakness that those sexual others, girls and women, impose on us. So girls, women, femininity, term that you used, becomes an enemy. And it's a kind of denial, if you follow this theory. Men want to deny that weakness in themselves. So they project it outwardly, and they perceive women to be the source of that weakness. So men come home from Vietnam. They are accused by veterans of older wars of having been weak. And so veterans of Vietnam, and they get a lot of help from popular culture in doing this, they begin to look to women, look at women, look at the feminine, quote unquote, in the culture as being responsible for what happened. And indeed, then what men see sort of logically is the rise of the women's movement, having largely occurred in the late 1950s and 1960s, as kind of validating that thought. They see that it was a lot of women in leadership positions in the anti-war movement. So the question is asked, who were these people who opposed the war while I was off fighting the war? Well, a lot of them were women. And who were these people who went to Hanoi during the war to make nice with the communist leadership in Hanoi? Well, the very first delegation to Vietnam to do this was Women Strike for Peace. Who was the most prominent person who went to Vietnam to treat with the North Vietnamese? Jane Fonda. So there's a lot going on in the culture that mixes in with these kind of innate fears, uncertainties, insecurities is probably the word, insecurities that men have about their own prowess to go off and fight the war. So a lot of men who might otherwise not have ever had these kinds of thoughts come home from Vietnam, having lost the war in Vietnam, and then have their anxieties and their insecurities built into Hollywood films, built into a lot of news reporters' questions and stories that they write. And it really becomes the basis for a whole post-war, a whole narrative about a lost war in Vietnam.
Having looked at this over a number of years, your work, David Courtright's work, I look at it, I suppose, now slightly more knowingly, and there's a sense that there's the veterans on one side and there's this mass of hippies and women who've betrayed them. but there's no space in that narrative. And it's probably significant for the massive number of mutinies, of strikes, of dissent from within the ranks. That's significant, surely, that the dissenting veteran is just kind of airbrushed out. And there was huge resistance from within the ranks, wasn't there, in Vietnam?
Well, there certainly grew to be by 1970. And you're right about that kind of being a space between, well, the two poles that I describe. There is a lot of space. There is a lot of space in there. And of course, there were a lot of men in that space also on the civilian side. My goodness. I mean, so many men acted with so much courage to oppose the war and resisted these kinds of cultural imperatives for them to show their manliness by going off to war. And it's important then to also say that the men who did that, the men who resisted on the home front, paid a serious price for that. Some went to jail. Some lost jobs. Some left the country and went to Canada. And then, of course, to the point of your question, yeah, there were by the late 60s, by 1970s, there was very strong resistance within the military itself. And I think a lot of that resistance was rooted in class. There's a great book that was written, the author's last name is Bates, and the title of the book is The Wars We Took to Vietnam. And one of those wars that he writes about is the class war. And lots of people who went to Vietnam were from working class and rural backgrounds. And they were not amenable to the authoritarianism of the military. So the same kind of resistance that we know is endemic, it's organic to the workplace, to the factory work floor. A lot of that goes along with particularly draftees who are sent to Vietnam. And when they see the officers, when they see the NCOs, what we call lifers in Vietnam, the career military people, they see the boss and they don't like the boss. They are naturally, preternaturally predisposed to resistance. And oddly enough, you know, not always outright resistance, but resistance to what they consider to be bad authority, bad leadership. Look, Captain, you want this job done. I can do it better than you're telling me to do it. You don't like that? Well, F you. Then I'm just not going to do it at all. It was, and I think this is important, that was the foundation of the resistance. It wasn't so much a kind of highly principled anti-war view or a pacifism rooted in religious belief. I don't think it was that. I think it began as class-based resistance to military culture. I think that was the beginning. That was the basis of it. And then by the late 60s, you began to get in Vietnam guys who had a brush with anti-war culture at home after the Tet Offensive of 1968 and the kind of stalemate that produced. William Westmoreland, the commander in Vietnam, wanted more troops, and he got more. And then President Lyndon Johnson reached down into the pool of age-eligible people and got people who had been deferred for college, people who had been deferred for occupational reasons. He got older, better educated people who had already had a touch with the anti-war movement. They might not have been recruited to the anti-war movement, you know, if that was the case, they probably wouldn't have gone. But by the time they got to Vietnam and they began to see the war, and they began thinking about, well, what about that leaflet that I read, you know, in Chicago? What about that speaker that I heard in San Francisco? Maybe there's something to the point that she was making. Maybe I should have listened. And by that time, there are people already in the military who are very ready to school everybody else on what is going on. So you see, there's a chemistry there between class, culture, class background, cultural forces, like I said, just education, age. You know, people who are drafted and they're 24 years old are not good, regardless of their class background, are not going to be very agreeable to military authority. I mean, let's just put it that way. And so all of these things begin to kind of cook. There's a kind of cultural chemistry, you see, that's going on. And so by, you know, roughly 1970s, that cohort of people, the Westmoreland cohort is what I called it in something that I wrote, that Westmoreland cohort of older, better educated draftees hits Vietnam on about the first of January, 1969. And that's really where I think things begin to fall apart, disciplinarily speaking, within the military in Vietnam.
I want to change our focus slightly on another major strand in your work, but also something very old. The stab in the back is very old. And so are discussions around military trauma. What I suppose we would now call PTSD. It's been called various other things in the past. Soldier's heart, shell shock. But you have a very interesting analysis of PTSD in Vietnam. And I suppose I'm still grappling with it myself. It's how dissent at some point became medicalized. That it was an easier explanation for maybe the American ruling class that someone was mad rather than they had become anti-imperialist. And so they went that way. Could you talk a little bit about your ideas around that topic?
Dissent is most commonly criminalized as traitorous. And that's a crime. Or if not criminalized, treated less dramatically as a behavioral problem. You're too young to take orders. You know, you grew up without any male father figure. And this does go back to the cultural, one of your questions alluded to this, that the feminine in the culture is considered to need direction, to need training. So young men who have not been parented by father figures are not going to make good soldiers. Again, that's kind of a theory. When these guys come home from Vietnam and they've been politicized by the war, and they come home looking for the anti-war movement to join, looking for a way to get involved in that, the American press really doesn't know what to do with that. It's kind of an embarrassment, I suppose, for the country as a whole. So how are we going to think about this? How are we going to think about these men who we sent off to fight the war, and they come home opposed to the war? And what kind of role models are they going to be for the next generation of men? They are not going to be the kind of role models that came home from the war in Europe or the war in the Pacific. We got to do something to re-image, to rewrite this. Now, by that time, by 1970, when the large number of people began coming home from Vietnam, I mean, the political opinion in the country has really shifted, you see, against the war. I don't have those figures at hand, but there's a large percentage of Americans who kind of admire these guys who are coming home opposed to the war. And treating them as criminals is distasteful. There's a feeling that, by golly, they're right. They were sent off to fight a war that was wrong. So their opposition to the war is justifiable, maybe even righteous. So it's not right to condemn them for their condemnation of the war. So how can we talk about these guys a little more sympathetically, right? And those became the seeds then for the medicalization of that. Well, they came home traumatized. They came home upset. Some of their activity against the war can be understood as catharsis, a kind of acting out on their anxieties, acting out on their disappointments, acting out on their uncertainties and their insecurities about coming home. I mean, even by that time, and I've just said that, well, a large part of the country had turned against the war at that time, but a large part had not. So these guys are coming home from Vietnam into a kind of difficult situation. We have to understand the difficulty of that. And so when they come out against the war, they come out protesting the war. We've got to understand that as a kind of emotional response, which then runs to, and I think you can follow this, that catharsis, acting out, you know, the next term in that lexicon is mental health. Psychiatrists jump on this like candy. And the press people, in order to kind of dramatize these stories, they began to use a whole different language, right? A whole different set of terminology. So it goes from, you know, the terminology of a kind of sympathetic terminology of catharsis, maybe depression, to terms like trauma. Hollywood picks up on this and begins to portray Vietnam veterans as dangerous, as violent, that they're bringing the war in the worst sense home with them. And some of this is taking the form of dangerous antisocial behavior. And these then is the way I write about it, and you may have already used this word, pathologizes the attitude, the mindset of Vietnam veterans. There's a difference between being upset and that being pathologized as a mental health condition that needs to be treated. And so the terminology goes from post-Vietnam syndrome, which was the early term that was used, to a full-blown diagnostic category, post-traumatic stress disorder, that then goes into the statistical and diagnostic literature in 1980.
I suppose when we're talking about the creation, just to nip back to stabbing the back stuff, you wrote in a very interesting way about a kind of the collection of forces which were at play when the mythology was created. And some of that is about the Nixon administration. Some of it's about something which will be unfamiliar to British people, called the John Birch Society. I think I'm saying that right. So the kind of American Christian far right. Could you talk about how the Nixon administration gripped this narrative? Because you write in a very interesting way about some of the kind of what they were doing behind the scenes and the kind of the way they were perceiving and trying to shape memory, I suppose, shape history in a way along the lines that suited them.
The John Birch Society alleged that there were disloyal elements within the government itself. Communists, in fact, had infiltrated the government. And so the war, the John Birch Society line was complex. They argued, first of all, that the war had been prosecuted in Vietnam by communists, knowing darn well that the U.S. could not win the war, and that then would catalyze anti-government behavior within the American population. That was one part of it.
Wow.
Yeah. Then, of course, the other part of it was that we lost the war in Vietnam because there were liberals in Congress who tied one hand behind our back. It was a favorite expression, and would not allow us to fight the war that needed to be fought. So the betrayal narrative then went right into the heart of Washington, D.C. The expression today that's very popular still today is inside the Beltway. Washington insiders is another expression. And you see, this is what fuels, this is what fueled the Trump movement. Liberals, liberalism, elites within Washington are responsible for why we lost the war in Vietnam. And it is these people that are the real enemy. Liberals, elites, are the real enemy of America. And these are the people that we have to go after. So Trump's campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, the again prior to Vietnam, the great fall, the great lapse, collapse came with the war in Vietnam. So what do we need to go back to? We need to go back to the 1950s. We need to go back to the years before the war in Vietnam. And we need to go after the femininity in the society. We need to go after these effete liberals, the intellectuals in the society. And we need to go back. We need to go after the class interests, you see, that are responsible for the lack of discipline and the kind of esprit de corps that we needed and didn't have in Vietnam.
I think it's happening on both sides of the Atlantic, Jerry, and I find it very interesting. I mean, there's the stab in the back theory, but I guess it's within the context of, I think you call it the culture war as well, which is very prominent here and centrally involves, I think Britain's foundational myth is D-Day, is the Battle of Britain, is Dunkirk, and all these things are suddenly very present. Every political issue is kind of coloured by the Second World War and the culture war around it. But also what jumps out at me, listening to you speak, is there's always a strong element of conspiracism. I mean, that John Birch conspiracy about the communists started the Vietnam War. I mean, I wonder when if you see any parallels. For example, start of this year, Capitol Hill raid, riot, whatever you want to call it. I understand there were, I think 1 in 5 of the people who were on trial, this was an article that month, were ex-military. Do you think there's something about the military which, or what is it about the military that makes people particularly susceptible to conspiracism? I know it's a broader question, but I'd love to hear what you have to say about it.
I think we're just beginning to grapple with that. I've gotten a few inquiries recently that are iterations of your question. The role of the military itself, it's, as we can see, I mean, just within the last week, very, very high-ranking military people have dissented from the Trump policies. They want nothing to do with that. And were these people, you know, the military people who were involved in this siege in January on the Capitol? There were apparently a lot of military people. Now, you know, one asterisk on that is that not everybody who says I was a Marine in Vietnam was really a Marine in Vietnam. And we might see some breakdown of those kind of identities. I'm a little bit at a handicap here because I was in Vietnam. I was in the Army in Vietnam. But the military today, I think, is a somewhat different institution than it was then. For one thing, there are no draftees today. So that changes things a lot right there. And I think that there's a lot to look at in what you're saying. And by the way, on the military dissent, senior military dissent, particularly apparently on Afghanistan, there's a whole lot that we're going to learn yet about the U.S. pullout of Afghanistan and how much of this is really about China. If the Taliban reconstitutes, or doesn't reconstitute, but if it reestablishes itself as a government in Afghanistan, will it again, as it did previously, harbor Muslim breakaway elements within China? You know, might the long game here that the Biden administration is playing, you know, really goes back to the, you know, taking China apart at its religious and ethnic seams, just as the former Soviet Union was taken apart that way. That's the way I see it. That's the question that's on my mind.
Sure. I wonder if you would agree. When I look at, I read your work and I look at what's happening today, I see the 60s and 70s, hippies, pacifists, and I look at today, the way the culture war and the narrative of betrayal are set up, and I see almost as if the hippies have been swapped out for Black Lives Matter. It's almost like we found new people to pin these narratives of betrayal on. I don't know if that's as pronounced in the States. I would imagine so. Is that what you sense? That the BLM are just the hippies of today in the context of the stab in the back?
No, I don't think so. Identity politics is really what's driving these social movements today. And whereas the hippie movement, I think, had a more general cultural tenor to it. And I think it's quite different.
So last one, I wanted to ask you about, you sent me one of your articles recently, and it's topic of another one of your books, I believe. The idea of the KIA, the missing in action, the killed in action, the story of, I suppose we're back to class struggle again. You write about class struggle among downed airmen captured by the Vietnamese, particularly in the context of John McCain. Could you just speak to that work a little bit for us? I find it very interesting.
Yeah, well, that's the most recent book, Dissenting POWs. There's a kind of untold story that within the POW population in Hanoi, the so-called Hanoi Hilton, within that population, there grew to be a lot of people who were opposed to the war, and some who probably came into the prison population already opposed to the war. And the most common background to those dissenters was class. We know from their memoirs and from some interviews that I and co-author Tom Wilbur did with some of those people, that because of their class background, they identified with the Vietnamese. They saw the poverty. They saw the stress of the war, the kind of almost hopelessness that the Vietnamese peasantry was put into. And they empathized with that. These were guys who were humanized by their very experience of having been captured and then people captured in the South and brought to the prison in the North, or the pilots who were shot down over the North. They were kind of brought to conscience by their very experience. And we think it's a wonderful case study in the kind of flip side of the more common narrative that war dehumanizes everybody. And we're saying with our book, wait a minute, these people came out a really hard time in prison. These were not pleasant conditions of being in prison in Hanoi at that time. And they come out of this as having been made better people. And we think that there are real lessons to be learned within that.
It's probably significant then that, I mean, obviously these people have very varied experiences, but if I was to summon the name of someone who's imprisoned in Hanoi Hilton, there would only be one name, and that would be John McCain, who is, of course, a very right-wing, recently departed John McCain, very right-wing, very pro-war, very neoconservative. Where are these missing people with these other narratives? Why is there no space for them?
Well, this goes back to what we've been talking about. When they came home, when these dissenters come home with the rest of the POW population in early 1973, they are first criminalized by the press as traitors. But then quite quickly, for reasons I already laid out, the narrative shifts to a mental health narrative. Well, they came out against the war because of the harsh conditions that they were living in. So either they turned against the war to gain favor, or because they were traumatized. They weren't thinking clearly, and we need to understand that. And so what these dissenters need now that they're home, they need mental health treatment. They need recovery. They need to go into recovery. And so they get written out of U.S. history, just like other dissenting GIs and service people mostly got written out of history until until I and a few other scholars began to bring that back, in mostly in the 1980s and the 1990s. But nobody even, like David Courtwright's book, just a tremendous, tremendous book, Soldiers in Revolt.
Fantastic.
Tremendous book. But Courtwright doesn't touch the POW issue. Or David Zeiger in his great film, Sir, No Sir, doesn't touch the POW issue. So it's remained a kind of untold story.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, we will signpost for our viewers all your work, of which I've made it obvious I'm a very big fan. But
thanks so much.
No, but thank you so much for coming on. We'll call it a day there. But many thanks to you for your time, Jerry.
Okay.
Take care.
This has been the Warrior Nation podcast. We'd like to thank our guest, Jerry Lemke. The show was produced and edited by Forces Watch and recorded at Liverpool Podcast Studio. Join us on the first Thursday in September for our next instalment. I'm Joe Glenton, and thanks for listening.